Chapter 3. Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks has taken a special interest in Claudette Colvin's case. She knew Claudette, and she herself had suffered a similar experience 12 years earlier. In 1943, she had been thrown off a Montgomery bus for refusing to re-enter through the back door after paying her fare. The bus driver had kept her money, ordered her to step aside, then driven away, leaving her standing on the sidewalk. Parks worked as a seamstress in a downtown Montgomery department store, where you had to be smiling and polite no matter how rudely you were treated. A soft-spoken woman of 42, she wore rimless spectacles and she had her brown hair braided and rolled behind her head. She was admired in the black community as a dedicated volunteer who had served as secretary of the local NAACP since 1943 and was currently an advisor to the organization's youth council, which counted Claudette Colvin among its members. Park had been training her high school charges to resist segregation wherever they could. Recently, she had sent them to whites-only public school libraries and to order books. Rosa had grown up on a humble Alabama farm not far from Montgomery. "I was a field hand when I was quite young, not more than 6 or 7," she recalled. "I was given a flour sack like the other children and expected to collect 1 or 2 pounds of cotton." Against great odds, Parks earned a high school diploma. At the time, Montgomery had no public high school for blacks. Rosa's family, ambitious for her advancement, arranged to send her to the laboratory school at Alabama State College, which trained black teachers. Rosa cleaned classrooms to help pay her way through school. After starting the 11th grade, she had to drop out to care for her ailing grandmother, but she managed to return to school after she married. Rosa received her diploma when she was 20 years old, becoming one of the small number of black high school graduates in the city at the time. "But that still didn't help me much in getting a job," she remembered. "I had a high school diploma, and the only jobs I could only get jobs that didn't need a diploma." She worked in a shirt factory as a helper in a hospital and a number other of menial jobs before being hired by the Montgomery Fair department store, where she altered ready-to-wear clothing. Parks made extra money by taking in sewing on the side. She had done some work for Virginia Durr, wife of attorney Clifford Durr, and the two women became friends. The Durrs, a white couple, were known in Montgomery as outspoken equal rights activists. They thought so highly of Parks' civic activities that during the summer of 1955, they helped arrange a week stay for Rosa at the Highlander Folk School in Mount Eagle, Tennessee, which held interracial workshops on how to promote integration. "That was the first time in my life I had lived in an atmosphere of complete equality with members of the other race," Parks said later. "I did enjoy going up there." On the evening of December 1st, 1955, Parks finished work and walked as usual to her regular bus stop at Court Square. Christmas lights were blinking in store windows and people were hurrying home past a big banner that read, "Peace on Earth, Goodwill to Men." She boarded a bus and paid her fare. She recognized the driver as the same man who had evicted her from the bus 12 years earlier. She found a seat in the middle section of the bus behind the whites-only section. Three other black passengers boarded as well and sat next to Parks in the same row. Soon, all 36 seats of the bus were filled, with 22 black passengers seated from the rear and 14 white riders from the front. Another white passenger boarded and stood in the aisle. The driver, James P. Blake, turned his seat to look behind him. He called to the first row of black passengers to stand up and move to the back. "Let me have those seats," Blake ordered. All four passengers in the row would have to move so that the white man would not have to sit next to a black. No one moved. Blake rose from the driver's seat and called out again. "Y'all better make it light on yourselves and let me have those seats." Reluctantly, three of the black passengers rose and moved to the back. Rosa Parks shifted slightly to allow the man next to her to get up, but she did not move from her seat. She was sitting in the white section, and she didn't think that she should have to give up her seat and stand in the aisle the rest of the way home. She had just spent the entire day tailoring and pressing clothes for white folks. Afterward, people would say that she didn't give up her seat because she was tired. But that isn't true, she wrote later. I was not tired physically, or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. No, the only tired I was giving in. She had made up her mind long before that if she was ever asked to give up her seat for a white person, she would refuse. Look, woman, I told you I wanted the seat. Are you going to stand up? The bus driver asked. No, I'm not, Parks replied. If you don't stand up, I'm going to have to call the police and have you arrested. You may do that, Parks replied, speaking so softly that Blake would not have been able to hear her if the bus engine had been running. Some of the black passengers, fearing trouble, started to get off of the bus. As I sat there, I tried not to think what might happen, Parks wrote. I knew that anything was possible. I could be manhandled or beaten. Soon, two Montgomery police officers arrived. Why hadn't she given up her seat, they asked. She felt like she shouldn't have to, she told them. Why do you push us all around? She added. I don't know, one police officer said. But the law is the law, and you are under arrest. Parks was escorted into a patrol car and driven to the city jail, where she was booked, fingerprinted, and photographed. Allowed one phone call, she called home. Her mother, who was living with her, answered. I'm in jail, Rosa told her. See if Parks, her husband, would come down here and get me out. Did they beat you? Her mother asked. No, I wasn't beaten, but I am in jail. Parks' mother called E.D. Nixon, who had headed the local NAACP chapter when Rosa served as its secretary. Nixon tried to reach attorney Fred Gray, but he was out of town. After leaving a message for Gray, Nixon decided to call the jail himself. When he asked the desk sergeant about the charges against Rosa Parks, he was told that it was, quote, none of his damned business. Nixon then called Clifford Durr, who was, as a white attorney, was able to get a civil answer from the desk sergeant. Parks had been charged with violating the state segregation laws. Clifford and Virginia Durr then accompanied Nixon to the city jail, where they posted bond for Rosa, and she was released. Mrs. Durr was the first person I saw when I came through the iron mesh door with matrons on either side of me, Parks recalled. There were tears in her eyes, and she seemed shaken, probably wondering what they'd done to me. As soon as they released me, she put her arms around me and hugged and kissed me as if we were sisters. Later that night at the Parks' home, Rosa, her husband Raymond, and her mother sat in the living room with Nixon and with Clifford and Virginia Durr as they discussed the details of her case and what to do about it. Nixon felt strongly that this was the test case he had been waiting for. Rosa was the ideal defendant. She had worked with Nixon for years at the NAACP, and he knew that she was a person of exceptional dignity and strength of character. She possessed the quiet confidence to challenge the white establishment. Nixon and Rosa asked Rosa if she would be willing to fight the charges against her to make her arrest a test case against the segregated buses. Mrs. Parks, he said, with your permission, we can break down segregation on the buses with your case. Rosa understood that this would be a momentous decision for herself and her family. Before agreeing, she wanted to speak privately with her mother and then with her husband. Both of them were upset at first. Raymond, a barber who knew at a nearby Maxwell Air Force Base, knew that violation often awaited blacks who dared challenge the system. Oh, the white folks will kill you, Rosa, he warned. Don't do anything to make trouble, Rosa. Don't bring a suit. The whites will kill you. Racially motivated killings were not uncommon in the Jim Crow South. Early that year, two black men had been shot dead in Mississippi while trying to register African-American voters. And that summer in the small town of Money, Mississippi, 14-year-old Emmett Till, a black youngster visiting from Chicago, was kidnapped and beaten to death by a mob of Klansmen after he allegedly whistled at a white woman. Emmett's mutilated body, wrapped in barbed wire, was found floating in the Tallahatchie River. Montgomery newspapers had given prominent coverage to the brutal killing in the speedy trial of the two white men accused of the crime, who were acquitted by an all-white jury. Several months later, the killers boasted to a journalist that they had indeed murdered Till. Rosa Parks had not expected to resist that on December evening she did not want to put her family at risk. But she was no longer willing to accept the indignities of bus segregation and a system that dehumanized all black people. I decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama. After talking it over, Rosa's mother and husband said that they would support any decision she made. If you think it will mean something to Montgomery and do some good, then I'll be happy to go along with it, she told Nixon. By now, it was late Thursday evening. Nixon and the Durs left and went home. Attorney Fred Gray, meanwhile, had learned about Rosa's arrest and had spoken with Rosa and agreed to represent her. Then he called Joanne Robinson, whom he knew from the Claudette Colvin case, and Robinson, in turn, notified several fellow teachers that the members of the Women's Political Council. It was all happening quickly, Gray recalled. The mood was electric. This was the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. At around midnight on December 1st, the day Parks was arrested, Robinson and her friends met at their offices at Alabama State College, supposedly to grade last-minute exams. Actually, they were going to draft a letter of protest calling on the black community to stage a one-day bus boycott on the following Monday, the date set for Parks' trial. The fastest way to print copies of the letter was on the mimeograph machines at Alabama State. High-speed modern copy machines were still in the future. However, the college was funded by the state, and the teachers were state employees. If officials learned that they had used taxpayer-owned facilities to challenge the segregation laws, then funding for the all-black school might be cut back and teachers might lose their jobs. The women swore one another to secrecy. They wrote and revised their letter, changing it repeatedly in the early hours of Friday morning. Then they stayed up the rest of the night, cutting stencils and mimeographing 52,500 leaflets. While the women were working, Robinson called Nixon at home to inform him of their plans for a boycott. He, too, had been busy throughout the night, phoning Montgomery's black ministers and other civic leaders, urging them to attend a Friday meeting evening to mobilize support for both the boycott and the legal defense of Rosa Parks. Early Friday morning, some students helped Robinson load leaflets into her car. She taught her classes from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., and then, accompanied by two senior students, set out to distribute the notices. Other women's council members were fanning out across town, doing the same thing. They stopped at black elementary, junior high, and high schools, where students were waiting to distribute the handbills in school so they could be taken home to parents. Leaflets were also dropped off at churches, stores, taverns, beauty parlors, barbershops, and every other available place. By the time the city's black ministers and civic leaders were ready to meet on Friday evening, thousands of anonymous notices had been circulated in Montgomery's black neighborhoods. Each leaflet read, "Another Negro woman has been arrested and thrown into jail because she refused to get up out of her seat on the bus for a white person to sit down. If we do not do something to stop these arrests, they will continue, and the next time it may be you or your daughter or mother. This case will come up on Monday. We are, therefore, asking every Negro to stay off of the buses Monday in protest of the arrest and trial." The leaflet urged the black community, "Don't ride the buses to work, to town, to school, or anywhere on Monday."